Well, good morning, Tennessee. My name's Harold, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here. I have a sobriety date, April 7th, 1987. I have a home group in St. Louis, Missouri, Strong Three Legacy Group. It's called AA on the Rocks. If you're ever in St. Louis on a Wednesday, come and see us. And we'd love to host you. And if we get a hold of you quick enough, we're going to put you to work, I can promise you. We will get some mileage out of your sobriety. It's been a great trip. My wife Susie's with us. Give it up for Susie. It's always good that she gets to come. It can be challenging sometimes with her work, but also because she's hearing impaired, and we can't fly most of the time without having a special procedure to put a special tube in her ear. And so a lot of times she don't get to come because we got to fly. But when she does, this was a nine-hour trip for us to get here. We got 9 hours to go home. So I know I'm the only thing between you and the road, so I get that. But we got probably 10 hours altogether with stops to get home tonight. So it's a long grind, but we'll get there. But I'm glad she came for the weekend. She knows a lot of these people. She loves a lot of these people. One of the last times we tried to fly with her, Bob and I were doing a workshop in Orlando. This is some years back, and her ear exploded on the plane. It was not a good situation. And so a year or two years ago, it was out at George's home group, Pacific group, and we drove out, and then we were going to fly back. And we did, and she was able to put that special tube to get there. Because we're going to the international, she's like, I can't do the tube for this. We can drive it, but I'm going to fly to the international. So she came. She's had a great time. So thank you for giving her a lot of love and showing her a lot of love. I'm grateful to be here. I come from a great line of sponsorship. My grand sponsor's here. My sponsor's not here, but his bride's here, you know. I got sponsee guys here. I got a lot of lifelong friends here. It's a privilege to be here. Really, it's just a privilege. Ben, thanks for inviting me to come. I love Ben, and I'm so excited for his new life, his new future bride, who's amazing. And I think that's amazing for Ben, you know, and it is bride. It really is. God bless you, Ben. So we got a lot of love in the room between Georgia and Trenton and Shaylin and Ben. It's a fun weekend, and a lot of long marriages that we heard here this weekend. I'm tasked to talk about the 12 step and how we get here, how we have this spiritual awakening, you know, as a result of that awakening. What are we commissioned to do? What are we called to do? And then try to live this principled way of life for the rest of our life out. And how do we do that? Definitely imperfect. But we heard a lot about Ebbies this weekend. We heard a lot about mothers this weekend. My mother was the rock star in my life, so I'll probably mention her. I definitely had a lot of Ebbies, and we're going to talk about step 12, so we're going to talk about some of those people, what that looks like. But, you know, this whole weekend's been beautiful. The speakers have been awesome. I know all of them. I love all of them. But they've just been, like Bob said last night, and everybody said, they've just been on their, it's just, they've been spirit-filled, and it's been amazing, and it's definitely charged my batteries. I could just simply say amen, and we can go home right now, seriously. But that's not what they asked me to do, so I'm going to share in a general way with that, and all I can share with you is what I've seen, what I've heard, and what I experienced, and that's what I'm going to share with you. That's it, nothing more. I'm not going to give you a bunch of this or that. It's just what I've seen, what I've done, and what I experienced. It has changed, it totally transformed my life. And if you're new here today, it's not just good news, friends. This is the best news ever if you're suffering from alcoholism. There is no better gig in town. There's no more kingdom of God experience, I think, on the planet than right here, right now. I mean, they're just not. The equality, the inclusion, when you walk in, you fill out a brochure. They don't get, you know, where are you from? Who'd you vote for? You know, what's your gender? What's your sexuality? No, hey, we're glad you're here. And there's no place like that on this planet that exists at that level. And we're sitting in the most kingdom of God space, I think, that there exists in the world. And we're here right now. And it's on fire, right? It's on fire. Thanks, Bill. There was an old theologian named John Wesley who said, if something's on fire, people want to come and watch it burn, right? And that's why this place is growing. That's why this thing's growing, because people want to watch it burn. They want to be a part of that fire. And the fire's been here all week. And it started with Barclay. I mean, there's only so many people that come here and go, yeah! Right? And just imagine Barclay on dog dope and Jack Daniels doing that. So Barclay's like a family member to us, so we love Barclay. So we've been brothers for a long time. So in 1979, it's how I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, through the Department of Corrections. And I just got released and picked up on another charge and brought to a detention center in northern Missouri. And they brought us to the detention center, and in this detention center, one day they come out and said, come out into this bullpen, and we came out because a couple guys were going to bring in a meeting to this space. And I can remember the CO said, if you don't want to die, you better get in here. If you don't want to die, you better get in there. Talking, because he knew all of us were just drunks and blowing our lives up. And we went out, and I think it's on page 105 of Bill Sees It as an excerpt from one of Bill's writings. And it's called, and the title of it, it's right in the middle of the page, it's titled Chief Responsibility. And I'm paraphrasing, but it goes on to say that our chief responsibility is to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous to the newcomer. As an individual, as a group, as a district, as an area, as a conference. It's our chief responsibility. And I can promise you this weekend's been an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, right? It has. You can. But it's so imperative, especially when you're trying to carry the message, whether it's in somebody's home, whether it's in a jail, whether it's in a prison, whether it's in a treatment center, to be an adequate demonstration. Because why? Because that audience, especially that audience, and it's really important, I think, to understand, they listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. They listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. They're going to watch how you carry yourself, how you walk, how you talk. Are you really full of the fire? Are you really full with the light? Are you illuminated? What message are you really carrying? How you carry yourself and how you walk into those spaces and talk in those spaces is everything. It's everything. And so that's really important. And it was for me. I couldn't tell you anything those guys said that day, but I can tell you what they did, you know, because I listened with my eyes. And I didn't want anything they had to offer. I was far too young to, at that point, and hadn't really done the big dance with King Alcohol at that point. But the message was planted, and a demonstration was given. I was given a plea bargain because I had a parole officer, and I had a prosecutor who understood my illness better than I did. And they said, look, here's the option. We can revoke your parole, charge with this new crime, send you back where you were for 2.5 more years, or you can go into treatment for 30 days. Now, I quit school when I was 13 years old, but I had enough mass to know that 30 days was a heck of a lot shorter than 2.5 years, right? It was a really quick plea bargain. And I went to treatment for the first time. By this time, the calendar rolled, and it's 1980. So it's 1980, I'm in this treatment center. And again, another adequate demonstration of recovery. Small rural treatment center, northern Missouri, Kirksville, Missouri to be exact. The name of the treatment center was Care Unit. And back then, at least in that part of the country, everything was 12-step driven, everything was big book driven, everything was AA driven. You didn't have to have all the certifications and all the things you need today. There wasn't so much science and medicine into treatment. It was just purely out of the book. Let's get it on. Let's do it. And they would take you on vans and they'd run you out to these meetings. And I remember it's like being on an old folks band, and when you're just a young punk juvenile like I was at this stage, you know, your little face is plastered against the glass. You look pretty pathetic if somebody pulled up next to you, a little tear down your eye. You're sad. But they took us to our first meeting, and one of the Ebbies in my life was this lady named Millie Mays, and Millie was a superstar in mid-Missouri. She was a rock star in recovery. And she looked like Santa Claus's wife, you know, from the cartoon. She had big white hair, big rosy cheeks, big smile, full of energy, full of life. And I walk into this meeting, and she greets me, and she bought me an orange crush soda out of the pop machine. I remember like it was yesterday. And we sat down. It was a small, rural, La Plata, Missouri, small little rural meeting. And everybody had to talk because there wasn't very many people there. And the time comes around, I got to say something. And I said, well, I'm here because the Department of Corrections said I had to be here. And I only got so many more days, and you will never see me again, because I'm not like you people. And this beautiful soul turned on me right in the meeting. And she grew horns, she grew fangs, she grew a tail, and fire shot out of her mouth. And right in the middle of the meeting, she says, just keep drinking, you dumb little bastard. It's all going to happen to you. And she became my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. But how things work if you stay. is that when she had her 30th anniversary, she asked me to come and speak at her anniversary. So it all came full circle eventually. But then I got, you know, it's time to go home. And my home plan was the Thomas Boys. And I don't know what, if the Thomas Boys were from where you're at, but you don't want the Thomas Boys as your home plan from where I'm at. And they rolled up in a pickup, and back then, you could all pile in the back of the pickup. I bet they never did that in Tennessee. Did they ever do that in Tennessee, the back roads of Tennessee? Everybody just piled in the back of the truck, truck's full. We hop in. We went to one of the best parties I've ever been to in my life on the Sheraton River. And they handed me a big plastic jug of what they call jungle juice, pure grain alcohol mixed with some punch or something. They gave me a couple pieces of paper with Snoopy on it. I don't know what that was about. I just know a little bit, in a few minutes, I was singing Hang On Snoopy, and off we went to the Sheraton River, right? One of the best parties I've ever been in my life. It was a summer party. It was great. And they gave me this 30-day coin for 30 days of sobriety. And the highlight, what I thought was a highlight of that whole evening, is I walked down to the river with that coin, and I skipped it across the river, and I pounded my chest, and I made some hillbilly rebel yell that we got victory over alcohol, over the DOC, and God bless America. And everybody's like, yeah! And that would be the last time I thought about not drinking for a long time, you know. But that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery. And it was an adequate demonstration, even though I was so far from removed from conceding that I was powerless over it. In 1987 is when my life crashed. And my life crashed hard in really an eight-week period. And I'm not here really getting into step one, but I'll just tell you how it all came to an end. I got arrested for a 4 TWI conviction. A few weeks later, I was playing music. I was a rock and roll drummer most of my life in those days. And we were coming back from playing a gig in East St. Louis, Illinois. I was passed out in the back seat. I wasn't even awake when all this happened. But we got involved in a multi-fatality drunk driving accident. And everybody in the other vehicle lost their life that night. And then a few weeks later, I got home from that. And I was just destroyed. It's like somebody took out my soul and cut it in half. I was absolutely crushed by all of it. Alcoholism was my master from day one. But now, you know, but here it is. It's sitting next to me, and I cannot get away from it because I'm so powerless over it. And I got behind the wheel of a car and got arrested for another DWI a few weeks later. Felony DWIs, parole violation, on my way back to the penitentiary. And in that cage, when I was in that cage, I got down on my knees and I said the most honest prayer I've ever said in my life. I've heard it a million times from this podium. And it was simply, God help me. And from that moment till now, I've never found it necessary to pick up another drink of alcohol, right? From that moment till now. And it was a huge surrender. I mean, in Bill's story, he would say, spiritually speaking, most people, you know, it's an educational variety. It happens over time. They have this spiritual experience, and it's going to take a while. But for him, it was sudden and profound. I would have subscribed to that mentality, that theology, that mindset for a big chunk of my sobriety. But one day we were in the prison, we were reading through this book, and we got to that part of the story when he said that his impact, God's impact on his life was sudden and profound. In hindsight, looking back, over 12 years later, I realized that God's impact on my life was sudden and profound, because from that moment, I got on that prayer, I never drank again. His impact on my life was immediate, but I just didn't wake up to it. And what you heard all week from every speaker up here has done an elegant job of describing the root of the problem, which I would say is spiritual separation. We're spiritually separated. And we can debate through science, through reason, through faith, and all those things why we are like that. Is it from birth? I would argue it's from birth. If you don't think so, take two three-year-olds. We'll call them Katie and Amy. Right? Put them in a room together and give them one toy. And you'll find out what I'm talking about really fast. But that's that. And so it would take a long time. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. In my experience, there's really, if I had to frame it in categories, there's three types of people that come to AA. There's those who make it happen, there's those who watch it happen, and there's those who don't know what's happening at all, right? And I've been all three of those people. And I absolutely had no clue what was going on when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Zero clue when I got here. And I watched AA happen. Yes, I got involved. The fellowship saved my life. I don't have any qualms with fellowship. It saved my life. I had a sober band. I went on sober float trips. I played on sober softball teams. I did all the sober fellowship stuff, and it saved my life. But I was on step nada. right? If you were at the last international conference, the person who spoke on Friday night from Australia said it best. I was doing everything right in AA, but 12 things, right? And that's my life. That was my life the first 3 years I was sober. So I was around. You would have thought I was running for office in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was no real transformation going on. I'm like, of course, if you've been abusing King alcohol in your life and you stop, you're going to get a little bit physically better, a little bit mentally better, a little bit emotionally better. You can easily say a little bit spiritually better. But it's going to plateau. And that spiritual separation is going to start in the wide. It's going to come to life again. And the irritable and the restless and the discontent is going to take over your life. And you're going to get to that space where you're going to grow or you're going to go. And that's what happened to me. And so this spiritual awakening, although, you know, I was having an awakening, it really didn't come until I had, and Bob talked about it beautifully last night, that second bottom or that third bottom. I think we all had to come to that bottom. I would describe that bottom, if I was going to give it a name, I would call it coming to the end of yourself. It's just, you got to come to the end of yourself, in my experience, before you're going to come all the way in, sit all the way down, and do this thing. You have to come to the end of yourself. And I hadn't come all the way to the end of myself. Even though it's King Alcohol is my master and everything it put me through, my entire life, I still wasn't at the end of myself. I still wanted to, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm going to do what I want, when I want, how I want, the way I want, and if you don't like it, too bad. Because that's how I flow. When I bailed out of that treatment center, this is where that adequate demonstration, really talking about step 12, comes into play. Because when I bailed out, there was nobody to call. We didn't have cell phones back then, but even if I had a cell phone, there would not, and this is the gospel truth, there was not one person in my phone that I could call. Mom been gone a long time. So I said, I got to get help. And I went all the way back to that treatment center I was at in 1980. Lots of treatment centers in St. Louis. That's where I went because of the adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I went there. I didn't go there to be what we're doing tonight. I didn't go there to be an AA. I didn't go there to be sober forever. I went there because it was the only desperation. It was the only place I knew to go. I needed a piece of paper to stand in front of the judge and plead for mercy because I was in a lot of trouble. I've been in trouble since I was 12 years old. And I went to the treatment center, and I was in there. I had seizures, and seizures really started for me right around age 15. I had my first alcohol withdrawal seizure, and I had that playing in the band 2 weeks after I got out of that first treatment center. And we were on a town square in Kirksville, Missouri, playing a gig for the United Way. The very last song, true story, Sunday morning, Ozzy Osbourne, Crazy Train. And I have a seizure, and I wake up with a drumstick in my mouth. My drums are all kicked over. And I rejected the paramedics. I went and got as sick as you could ever get in the bathroom and just vomited all the toxics that I put in my system the night before. But I ended up in the hospital. They've convinced me that it might be epilepsy or I might have a brain tumor. That sounded a lot better than I got to quit drinking. What's a little brain tumor, a little epilepsy? So let's go confirm what I'm hoping is true, right? But it wasn't. And we got there, and this is where my mom and I parted ways. I was 15 years old at this stage of my life. This is 1980. And my mom's sitting next to me, and this Abby, this Laverne, who was in charge of the treatment center, who was just an amazing soul, came in to give me the A pitch, came in with the book one more time, sitting next to me, and gave me the invitation that we're all given. You know, are you willing to go any lengths to do this thing? And I rejected that offer. I said, no, I'm not. Because it didn't seem like a solution to what was going on in my life. And my mom got off the train. My mom had been married to two alcoholics, one in St. Louis, Missouri. She had a son and two daughters, and it drove her insane. The toxicity and the drama, and Larsine spoke about it beautifully. It was insane. And my mom just left the marriage. I mean, just left. Was MIA for 10 years. Nobody knew if she was dead, if she was alive, she was gone. And she ended up on the western side of Missouri in a state mental hospital, and she was there for quite a while. And somehow or another, she got well enough to get out of there, and she met another alcoholic, or maybe she knew him beforehand, which happened to be my dad. I came out of that marriage, but after about 2 years of that rodeo and all that toxicity again, you got to go, man. And she ran him off, and it was just her. Her parents died young. I never had any grandparents. I didn't have any great-grandparents. I didn't have any aunts. I didn't have any uncles. The only thing that was in my life was my mother. And thank God my mom turned her will and life over to the care of God. She understood God that night, that time. And that was her, through her Catholic faith, and she never wavered on that until she died in 2015, and she became one of the most remarkable women you've ever met in your life. And there's nothing, I know I'm biased, but I've been hanging out with some amazing women all week, but I'm really biased on this, but there's really nothing more beautiful than a woman who's walked with God for a long time. And my mother was one of those people. But she was done. She's like, kid, when you get out of here, you can either do this or you can go this way, but I'm done with you. And being an NFL Marlboro leather on leather guy was, I like, you know, yeah, mom, I don't need you either. That's what half of me said. The other half was, I can't even believe my own mom didn't love me anymore, but I rejected it and I chose to leave. And I left home when I was 15 years old. And I hooked up with a biker guy, or a drifter. He was a biker, but he's also a drifter. And he had a panel van, and he was just a drifter in my town. I hooked up with him, and we just took off. And that's a whole story in itself. But I went all over the South, and I ended up in Texas, ended up in Knoxville for about 6 months, ended up in Nashville for about 6 months, and I finally landed in Acworth, Georgia. And there was a great Southern boy named Charlie Daniels, right? He wrote a song in 1979, "The Devil Went Down to Georgia." Right? Guess what? He found me. He found me in Acworth, Georgia. And that's where I had my first any kind of moment of clarity with alcoholism. First time in my life. Is in that place. And I woke up from a blackout in an old beat up trailer. We lived in a beat up old trailer. We lived in an old trailer park in Acworth that was nothing but hillbilly rejects from the South. How bad was it? I lived next door to three guys named Porkchop, Hollywood, and Screwdriver. That should give you an indication how life was going for me. But I woke up from a blackout. I've been a blackout drinker from day one in my life. And I woke up, and it was wintertime. I had on cowboy boots. I had on blue jeans. I had on a flannel shirt. I had on a beige vest. And I woke up with a big tomato head, because that's what we called a hangover in the South, was a tomato head. And I had a big tomato head. And I looked down, I had dry blood all over my hands, all over my jacket. And I couldn't figure out what had happened to me. And I went into the bathroom and trying to figure out if somebody kicked the dog's not nasty out of me, which wasn't uncommon. But I couldn't find it until I got undressed and I realized somebody sliced me all around my arm and then stabbed me in my rib cage. To this day, I couldn't tell you what happened. What happened next is really, I think, the most important part of it as it relates to alcoholism. Because I went out on the front porch for the first time in my life at 19 years old. And I was so oppressed by alcoholism, so enslaved to it. And I'm sitting there trying to smoke a cigarette, and I mumble something to the effect, man, I got to do something different than what I'm doing. And King Alcohol, the authors of our big book, they took King Alcohol, they personified King Alcohol, gave him an old English character named John Barleycorn. It was just like John Barleycorn sitting right next to me. Call him the Great Compromiser, because he'll meet you where you're at. I don't even care if you have this book, as long as you don't read it. And do what it says, you know, you go to these meetings. But he's sitting there next to me, and I'm mumbling something. Man, I got to do something different when I do it. And this is what he says. You know what, kid, you're right. You do need to do something different than what you're doing. But before you do anything drastic, grab your old army jacket, and let's walk up here to the magic market and get a pack of smokes and a quart of beer. And it sounded like a really good idea. And I started walking up to the liquor store. I didn't even wash the blood off my hand. I got the army jacket, and I started that jog up to the liquor store. And I got up, and before I ever got there, I'm already feeling better. I'm almost skipping to the liquor store. I'm already feeling better. The sense of ease and comfort's coming over. And I get the bottle. I get the cigarettes. I come out, I twist the cap. Psh! Make that noise we all love, right? And that white spirit of King Alcohol comes out of that bottle. And I take a big, mighty pull out of it. Make that pucker face we always talk about. We always take. And that was the last time I thought about not drinking for a long time. And I hitchhiked to Marietta, Georgia. And got sewed up, and that was the last time I thought about not drinking for a long time. That's King Alcohol. And that's the mindset. That's the illness that brought me to this treatment center. So I get into this treatment center in 1987. I have another seizure. So it took me a little bit to get into out of detox. But eventually the day came when I got a knock on my door, and this guy walks in. His name's Gary. Gary's got 2.5 months of sobriety. And he's got a Kansas City Chiefs hat on. He's got prison-issue glasses. And he says, hey, guess what? I said, what? He goes, you're on the list. I said, the list for what? He goes, you're on the list to go to a meeting. I said, what kind of meeting? He says, an AA meeting. I said, man, I'm not going to no AA meeting. He goes, you sure? I said, I'm positive. I'm not going to no AA meeting. And he says, all right, and he leaves. And then he comes back a few minutes later, and he opens the door, and he sticks nothing but his head in. He says, do me a favor. I said, what's that? He goes, try really hard to smile and get it over with. And then he left. And I'm like, what is that? You know, smile and get over with. But, you know, when our book says that an alcoholic properly armed with the facts about themselves can win the confidence of another alcoholic, and just, well, it didn't take a few hours. It took like 30 seconds. And I start looking for this guy. I go out scouring the halls, and I finally found him. I go, hey, you still going to that meeting? Yeah, I'm still going to that meeting. I said, man, that's great. He goes, why is that great? I said, because I want to go with you. He goes, that's even greater. I said, why is that even greater? He goes, because I can't get anybody else to go with me, right? So now you know you swallowed the hook. And so we go out, and it's a true story. A two-story little treatment center in Kirksville, Missouri. We go down to the parking lot, and we could take just this section right here and pass the hat and pay for his car. It was a 1970 pea green Plymouth Duster, piece of crap car. Floorboards were rusted out. He had some floor mats, hot wired stereo system, box speakers in the back seat, right? And we get in the car, and we crank this thing up. There's no exhaust on it. And we're in a small town. We're going down to where all the churches are at. And we go, boom, and carbon dioxide's pouring through. And you're trying not to die from asphyxiation. And he's got a smile that wraps around his head. Why? Because he's got the new guy. He's going to show up and score some points at his group. And he starts giving me the A pitch, telling me how great his life is. And I'm looking at his car. I'm looking at his prison-issue glasses. And I think I invented the word right there on the spot. Dude. I hate to admit it to you, but it really looks like your life sucks to me. And alcoholics are quick. He goes, well, tell me about your car. I don't even have a car. Right? And rumor has it you got a big trial coming up. How's that working for you? But I got to the meeting. And before I went into the meeting, the guy goes, hey, I want to give you some great advice. Here's what I want you to do. We're going to go to this meeting, but if they would call on you, all I want you to say is your name's Harold and you're an alcoholic. Don't add anything to it. You're from the Ozark Mountains. We know you probably smoked some of that, huffed some of that, sniffed some of that. You probably even slept with a few farm animals, too. Let's just be right. We already know alcoholism's got a broad definition. But just be Harold the alcoholic. I've been Harold the alcoholic from day one. You know, it saved me a lot of grief in recovery, I can promise you. But I went in and sat down, and I sat down next to this guy. And I asked him this question. And maybe if you're new here, you got this question. And it's a fair question. How long do we got to come here? And it was a serious question. How long does this take? Whatever it is we're doing, how long does this take? And the guy's like puzzled by it. He looked at me and he goes, until you want to. And it was like really sad news. I didn't want to be there that night. Much less the next night. And I darn sure didn't want to be there when I looked like him. And guess who I look like today? I look like, it's like that guy. But I came back to St. Louis, and I didn't go to AA. I was just consumed with this trial. That's it. It absorbed every second of my life. And I came back, and this Abby, this guy, this adequate demonstration, we didn't have text, we didn't have anything. He called me on the phone. Did you go to a meeting? No. Why? I don't know why, Gary. Very defensive about it. He goes, man, your life depends on it. And I knew that's true. This is a guy with 2.5 months of sobriety. He wasn't trying to be my sponsor. He wasn't trying to take me through the steps, but he was definitely filled with the light. He was definitely filled with the fire. He definitely had the spirit. He definitely was sharing the best news ever. And he wanted me to have it. And he knew my life depended on me having it. And he stayed with me until I finally went to my first meeting. But I told you how I showed up. And I grinded it out for 3 years in AA. And what really brought me to the bottom, to be transparent, is AA boy meets AA girl on campus. And I met a girl, and she got pregnant immediately. And she was only 6 months sober. I was 2 years sober. She was 6 months sober. And she said, you know, I'm out. I'm not doing recovery no more. I'm out of this thing. I'm see you later. Whatever. Have a good life. I'm taking a baby. I'm out. And she left. And I didn't have nothing. I had no resources in my life. I had to, you know, steal from Paul and write a bad check to Peter, you know, just to try to do anything. And I filed a paternity suit against her. But long story short, I think the guy she is with the whole life, her old time, somebody she worked with, they got married and filed a suit to adopt this child. And I took on that suit. But I was 3 years sober. I just got a sponsor. I was just starting to work the steps. I mean, just barely. And we go to court over that child. And this is really what brought me to my knees in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we get to the trial, and I'd never been to a trial ever in my life where I felt more confident about the outcome ever than this one. I'm sober. My sponsor's there. My boss is there. My family's there. My mother's there. My new wife's there. Kids are there. AA members are there. I'm pretty stoked about this deal until they call me to the stand and that prosecutor gets up. And he filleted me like a fish. And the judge said, based on the evidence that we heard here today, we think it's in the best interest of this court, this child, we're going to revoke Mr. Long's rights as a father. Adoption's accepted. Case dismissed. Worst sentence I ever got in my life. And there was zero alcohol involved in it. And it happened right here in these rooms. Katie mentioned it. We look back in our lives, we see we made decisions based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. I would love to tell you a great, warm story. When she turned 18, my sponsor was Tom I for a big chunk of my sobriety. Steve Lee's my sponsor now, but Tom and I wrote a letter, and we made connection, and we were just back and forth. She knew her half-sisters and all that. But that guy that she married stayed with them. They had two other daughters. She went to Mizzou. She graduated on her. She's married to a naval attorney today. They got three kids, and she's had a super blessed life. So if he wanted to pray for a great outcome, that would have been it, right? But it was a cost. I paid a price. And that's what really brought me to my knees and showed me what the root of our problem was, which is spiritual separation. Whatever you want to call it. You don't even have to put the word spiritual, but you are separated. I guarantee you, from the power in this room, from the people in your world, you've been separated your whole life, long before you ever took a drink. I guarantee you. Your inventory will prove it to you. And you're driven. You're driven by so many false narratives and so much delusion in your life. The delusion of what I would call the delusion of inequality was the thing that drove my life my whole life. I can do any inventory and look at my life and see where the delusion of inequality drove my life. What you thought of me paralyzed me. I would change my body. I would change my looks. I would change my clothes. I would change my zip. I would change everything. Just and the dark side of that is there's two narratives going on at the same time. I walk into a room like this, and one narrative is I want everybody to pay attention to me and tell me we're good. The other narrative going on at the exact same time is I want you to leave me the hell alone. And the kicker is I want you to do it at the same time. So like if everybody here just walk up and say, Harold, you're great, not talk to me the rest of the time, I'm good. But that's not reality, right? That's not reality. Thanks, Barkley. And it's not reality. And so that drove my life. And I can look at my inventories, and I don't think any of us would want to know how many poor choices we made based on that delusion. If the data could be pulled up and just show it to you on a spreadsheet, you'd want to leave the room when you find out how many poor choices you made on that delusion alone. And when I met King Alcohol, it numbed that delusion, baby. That was the magic of King Alcohol. So when I came in and finally came to my first aid meeting, it was common sense to me that I put down the alcohol, my life's going to get better. And it did get better. That's part of the delusion. It did get better. But I was still so blocked off. And I finally humbled myself, and I asked this guy to sponsor me. It took me 3 years to do that, and all the pain and consequences that went along with it. And I went to his house, and his name was Roy. I said, Roy, will you be my sponsor? And the reason I asked him, because I could walk to his house. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a license. And he agreed to it. He had about 11 years of sobriety. And we sat, and he goes, well, you've been around for about 3 years. Tell me about your life. I said, I'll tell you about my life. I said, I'm 25 years old, going on 26. I don't have an education. I got a criminal record. I don't have a driver's license, probably never will for the rest of my life. I don't have a GED. I don't have a car. I live in the basement of an old house up the street from you that I walk to. I got a dead-end job. I said, Roy, my life sucks, man. Sucks. Capital letters, highlighted, italicized it. Sucks. And I hadn't drank in 3 years. And he said, Harold, I'm going to be the first one to admit you've been dealt a really tough hand in your life. I'll be the first one to admit it. But I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. That every single thing you have in your life, sitting right here at my table right this second, every single thing you got going on, you've attracted it to you by the person that you've become. And the day you're man enough to own that truth is the day you're on your way to some real change. But so you can own that truth. This vicious cycle you're on, you're eventually going to drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. I know you don't think so. You got a desire, but you're like a candle blowing wind. Eventually it's going to go out. You're either going to return to the drink or you're going to do what my dad did. My dad was an alcoholic who never could get sober. And at age 54, he took his life. That's how my dad quit drinking. So you're going to do one or two things, man. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And it's a question every single person here, if you're truly a hopeless alcoholic, has to ask that question. Not once, probably several times in your life. Do you want to grow or do you want to go? And I didn't want to go. And I knew he was going to say, let's work the steps. And the steps just didn't make any sense how it was going to fix my problem because I was so full of consumerism, materialism, secularism, individualism. My mindset was, call me crazy, but I think I could be a little bit more spiritual if I had a few $100 in my pocket. And a driver's license. And a car that wasn't held together by bumper stickers. And a better looking girl, or a girl at all. Call me crazy. I think if I get a little of that going on, I could be a little bit more happy, joyous, and free, you know? But that wasn't the mathematics. The spiritual mathematics was you put the spiritual ahead of the material and the rest of it follows. My sponsor, Tom, had a beautiful quote, the definition of a miracle. He'd say, the definition of a miracle, Harold, is when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, great things can happen in your life. But you're not prepared for the opportunities. So once you get prepared for the opportunities, things will change for you. And it couldn't be a truer statement. And I finally got on board. I started to work the steps. And it didn't happen in a big cataclysmic explosion, but little by little, my life started to change. 2 + 2 didn't equal 4 anymore. The impossible became possible. And I went on to live this storybook life that I live today. But I had to come to the end of myself. And some people, it's the minute they walk in the Alcoholics Anonymous, they've had enough. King Alcohol has killed and crushed them in every way, and they're just done. They come in, and there's those people. And God bless them, but there's just a lot of people like me that just, under this false narrative that I just put down the booze and things are just going to just change. And it's not true. But I started to work the things, and things started happening. So this is how the spiritual awakening came for me. I just started working the steps. I did the inventory. I shared all the deep start secrets that I planned to take to the grave for me. Although I didn't realize they were the very things that were going to put me in the grave, right? But I was able to share those things. I was able to start reconciling my life. Being restored, I think is a word we don't use enough in recovery, is the word restored. To be restored to what I always was. Alcoholism didn't take it from me. It just covered it up. It's always there from day one. I just didn't see it. I didn't know it. I didn't know I was spiritually separated. Didn't know any of that. But little by little, I started to put those things together, and life started to take off. I got married. I had another child that I could legally keep, and they handed it to me. I didn't know I could fall in love with a little bald-headed woman with no teeth, right? Until he gave me one. And Susie and I got together. She brought 3 children into the marriage. I had 2. We got 4 girls, 1 boy, 4 grandkids. Amazing life. And here's the cool part. None of my kids have ever seen me abuse alcohol in any form. They've never seen me do anything too crazy. And that's being transparent. Even say a cuss word. That's just how the principles of this life has shaped who I was and how I am today. And it's just, we have an amazing life. It's not perfect by no means, but it's a pretty awesome deal. And I was able to finally reconcile, make amends to my mom after 3 years. And was the greatest winner of my life. The only person in my life, but she was the greatest winner of my life. And able to reconcile with my mom was huge. It took 3 years for that to happen. When I had a year of sobriety, I called her up. I said, man, I think I need to find my dad and tell him that I'm sober. She says, well, come over. Let me see what I can do. And she called me the next day. She says, you need to come by the house. And I came. When I walked in the house, she's sitting at the kitchen table, and she's sobbing. And I knew she was going to tell me my dad was dead. And he died in 1986. This is 1988. This is how torn apart my family was. He died almost 3 years before that. Never knew it. And he took his life. So it was a long period of reconstruction, no doubt. But as I stayed sober, things started to happen. The opportunities came. I got jobs I didn't deserve to have. My mom brought me into her business. She said, I'm going to bring you into the business. I said, Mom, they're not going to hire me. She worked for a huge national insurance company. I said, Mom, they're not going to hire me. I don't even qualify to take out the trash. She said, let me worry about that. And so she got me a couple interviews, and I got through the first 2. I don't know how. I had to borrow a tie from the guy next door. He worked at Budweiser. He had no tie. And it's true. He gave me a clip-on tie that came down about here. This is how I show it. to the last interview is with the vice president who became the president of this company. And I go to see him, and I sit down, and he looked at me, and he was almost in disgust. He goes, "You know, the only reason you're here is because of your mom. You know that, right? There's nothing about you that gets me excited. Nothing. This is how the interview is going." I mean, immediately. He said, "I love and respect your mother. This is her spiritual walk. This is her spiritual disciplines." She goes, "If I hire you, it's because of your mother, nothing more, nothing less. And if you work here, you're going to do three things. You're going to do them well. You're going to work hard. You're going to work smart. You're going to work honest. And if you can't do those three things, you will not be here. Do you understand that? Tell me you understand that." I said, "I understand it. Get out of here." And they hired me, and I got a chance of a lifetime to work at this company. And I started doing that, and I started to get some education in the insurance and financial services world. I got all these fancy initials behind my name. But it wasn't long into it that I finally hit a plateau, and I applied to do something, and the HR department says, you got to have a formal education to get here. You don't even have a GED. How did you get a job here? You know, I'm starting to backtrack. I said, "It's divinely inspired." So I "Well, you got to have at least a GED." And I went to my sponsor, and I'm double-digit sobriety. I'm 30 years old. And he says, "Well, you need to go sign up for a community college." I said, "Are you crazy? You want me?" I said, when I was incarcerated, I tried a couple times to get a GED. I could never pass it. I get frustrated and just quit. He goes, "No, you got to go." So I signed up for community college. In the first 16 weeks, I'm 30-something years old, double-digit sobriety. I show up to this classroom, and they thought I was the teacher. Seriously. And I sat down where I didn't have to look at any of them, because when I was a kid, I took the thumbtack out of my KISS poster and pierced my ear. That was a pretty big deal. I got a lot of fights over that. Now, they're all tatted out, all pierced out. Some of them have so many piercings, they look like they fell down the nut and bolt section. Hello or something. I mean, they got a lot going on. So I sat in the front where I don't have to look at any of them. But I got a kid named Robbie sitting next to me. Robbie's got a crew cut, shaved head, bunch of different colors in his hair, Judas Priest jacket on, you know, spike neck. I mean, he looked like he belonged in a museum. He was a beautiful specimen. And you couldn't help but look at the guy. And the teacher's not even there yet. And he jumps bat on me in this little classroom with these kids. "What are you looking at, old man?" That's what he called me. And I remembered a lot, some good humor from way back. I said, "Well, Robbie," right in front of everybody, I said, "you know, I made love to a parrot one time. And I'm wondering if you might be one of my kids." I couldn't resist it. He set it up. And Robbie became one of my best buddies in 16 weeks. But I graduated and went on to college, and I finally finished a bachelor's degree, stayed on the dean's list all the way through it. I sent my mom a bumper sticker and said, "Hey, your kid made the honor roll." It was a big joke that I had. But eventually got an MBA degree and wrote a thesis on starting a business from scratch and ultimately selling it. And I did that not once, not twice, but three times. And ultimately go on and get another master's degree and almost finish with a doctorate degree. So the impossible becomes possible every day in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous if you just stay here. But what really shifted all that, and what really gave me the life that I have today, is what we're going to talk about now, and that's step 12, the carrying the message piece, what this thing is all about. You know, the highest place you'll ever get in Alcoholics Anonymous is trusted servant. It's it. It's the highest status. I don't care what you do, where you go, how hard you work, trusted servant is all you're going to be. But it's the most special job you could ever have, to be gifted with that. And so my sponsor said in 1990, he says, "Harold, do you want to have a storybook life?" I said, "Yes, I want a storybook life." "Then there's two things you're going to have to do for the rest of your life, one day at a time. And if you do these two things, you will have a storybook life. I promise you, you will." And I said, "What are those two things?" "Number one, you always have a new guy you're working with. If you don't have a new guy you're working with, you stop what you're doing, you get out your rod, you get out your bait, you go fish where there's fish, but you always have a new guy you're working with. Always. Number two, I want you to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. And you can pick where it's at. I don't care where it's at, but somewhere you don't want to end up, I want you committed to doing that one day at a time for the rest of your life." And that's been 35 years ago. And that's exactly what I've done for 35 years. I've always had a new guy, and I've always went somewhere once a week I didn't want to end up. And that started into Skid Row Missions in 1990 in St. Louis, Missouri, on the Harbor Light Street. Hardest day I ever did in my life, still there today. It's a tough place. We still go there. But I went there every Thursday and every Saturday. By far the hardest day I ever did in my life. But in 1993, a phone call came in and says, "Hey, man, do you want to come out and give a talk at this prison?" I started laughing. I said, "Dude, do you know who you're talking to?" "Yeah, we know who we're talking to." I said, "Man, they're not going to let me come out to no prison. Are you out of your mind?" He says, "No, you've been off paper long enough, and I have a lot of pull in this institution. I'm pretty sure I can get you in." I said, "Well, let's just say you're right. Let's just pretend for a moment you're right. Let's play let's pretend." I made it pack a long time ago that I ain't ever, never, ever going back on that side of the fence for you or anybody else for the rest of my life. And he goes, "Yeah, yeah." He goes, "Run that by your sponsor and call me back." Right, you know how that went. I only have to tell you the story how that went. But I got in, and long story short, I became a volunteer in corrections, and mostly in maximum security or high security prisons. And I've been doing that ever since for 35 years. And I could sit here all day, literally all day, and tell you story after story after story after story after story how this has changed my life. It might change my family's life. It's an amazing experience. My friend Liz and Matthew are here. I got a young kid that's coming out of prison. He got out on Friday, so I couldn't be with him. But I said, "You call me every day, check in." And he was checking in when I put him on speaker. So we all talked to him, said hello to him. He's been out. He just got out Friday. I'll hook up with him on Monday. But he got out. He's with his mom in the car. I said, he goes, "I got you on speaker." He's with his mom. I said, "Hey, everybody said hi, mom." Everybody said hi to his mom. But this kid's been down for a long time. But if we connected years ago in the prison, he's out. I'll see him Monday. And there's no better journey than walking shoulder to shoulder with somebody else and helping them rediscover life. It's what this thing's all about. You heard it all weekend from amazing speakers. The transformation. Bob talked about it eloquently last night. He always does. That you got to move from a taker to a giver. In my experience, if that doesn't happen, you won't stay here. You may not ever drink again, but you'll get burnt out on all this stuff, and eventually you get sick of how it works. You get sick of it. You'll leave. But if you have that shift, it'll change everything for you. I'll share one story here because it involves Georgia. She's part of this story, and she just got done sharing, so we'll connect the dots. So in a maximum security prison in 1996, you know, as we were working with these guys, we realized we couldn't. We had a great meeting. It was on fire. People were just lining up, signing up to get in our group. But we weren't into the steps. We weren't into sponsorship. I mean, we got to do something different. So we had a group conscience, and a few of us wrote this workshop for prisons, right out of the third edition of the Big Book, and it was just questions pulled right out, all 164 pages, go through the 12 steps. So we wrote this workshop, and we signed up, we had people sign up for it, and we capped it at 25 guys, 25 offenders sign up for 16 weeks, let's go, let's get into this book, let's do this workshop, through these worksheets. All the guys who signed up to the internet workshop had life sentences or more, every single one of them. And the same 12 steps that transformed my life transform theirs. And we saw the shift. It was not about having a fantastic meeting. It was about getting the spiritual separation dealt with, right? That was the root of the problem, even in a maximum security fence yard. So this particular guy's name was Brent. He's one of the guys, a mini. But Brent came into our group just like everybody else. He listens with his eyes and he thinks with his feelings, right? And he had his head down. It took him months before he even say who he was without being called on. But he got into the workshop, and it changed his life. When he came to prison in 1987, he had two life sentences. Two life sentences, second-degree murder and armed criminal action. And through the resentment and his alcoholism, he ended up murdering his father. So that's what he was in prison for. He came to prison in 1987 when I almost came back to prison in 1987. We grew up 25 miles apart from where we were born. We're the same, exact same age. We're in this prison together, and we start working the steps, and I start sponsoring him. And his mom was gone, his grandma was gone, his wife divorced him. But as he started to work the steps, the transformation started to happen inside a cage community. And eventually, grandma came back to see him. And then his mama came back to see him. And then he got a letter from his ex-wife, and he's like, "What's that about?" And then she called and said, I heard you're doing some good things. I'd like to come and see you." And she came back, and they redid their vows and got remarried. But he even went up 5-year setback, 2-year setback. But eventually in 2006, he walked into our prison group with a smile that wrapped around his head. He goes, "Man, you're never going to guess what happened." I said, "Dude, I come here with holy anticipation every single week. What happened?" He says, "I got an out date." I said, "You got an out date?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm going home in 2008. 2 years later. I said, well, 2008 comes around. I said, when you get out, you call me every single day until I tell you not to call me or connect with me. I've been connected to Brent every single day since that time. Every single day. I never missed through that time to this time. But he's on his way home, and he calls me on a cell phone. He goes, dude, I'm in the car. I'm just letting you know, I'm in the car with my wife. I'm on my way home. I'm on a cell phone, man. Pretty cool. I go, yeah, I got one. I know what they're about. He's pretty excited about it. I said, get home, enjoy your family, call me in the morning. Call me the next day. And I could hear, not happiness. Happiness is very circumstantial. This was joy. This is pure joy. And I'll never forget the phone call. I'll never forget it. He called me. He says, man, you're never going to guess what I've been doing all morning. I said, dude, you haven't been with your wife for 21 years. I know what you've been doing. As soon as he got done laughing, he goes, no, man, that's not what I've been doing. I said, I've been sitting here opening gifts all morning. I said, gifts, what, welcome home gifts? He goes, no, man, I've been opening Father's Day gifts, birthday gifts, and Christmas gifts since 1996 when he started the program at Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you'll never guess what I got for Christmas in 97. I said, what'd you get? He goes, I got a Miami's Dolphins jacket. I don't know why he likes the Dolphins. That's how deep, you know, the disease really goes. It goes deep. But he goes, I got this jacket. And I go, but this is the spiritual mathematics we always talk about, Brent. I said, because right here on my desk, I got 4 tickets for you to see the Rams play the Dolphins in 4 weeks here in St. Louis. That's when the Rams are still in St. Louis. He goes, well, who am I going to take with me? I said, you take whoever you want. He says, you go? Hell yeah, I'll go. He goes, we'll take Bob. Bob had life in 45. And we'll take Gary. Gary had life in 20. All three of these guys got sober at the same time in that prison group in 1996. So we went to the game. We had pancakes. We went to the game. And we had a time of our life. And at halftime, the lady sitting behind us, she got our attention. She goes, hey. And we all turn around and look at her. And she goes, I've been watching you guys. I go, yes, ma'am. She goes, you guys are having a hell of a lot of fun. I go, yes, we are. You guys aren't even drinking. I said, no, ma'am, we're not. She goes, well, it's a good thing. I said, why is that? She goes, because the way you guys are carrying on, you probably end up in prison or something. Right? True story. True story. So Brent went on to have a storybook life. And his wife, unfortunately, was injured seriously in a car accident and then lost her life. And he, after he got some time and got off parole, people would call, of course, like this, hey, can you come and speak? I can't, but I got somebody who might. And we've done several things together. And he got invited to go to North Texas Roundup to speak. And while he was there, he met another speaker that was from George's home group who was there to help fill in, actually. She was there to fill in for somebody else, and dynamic woman. They met, got googly-eyed like these two did, you know, like these two did. And he finally says, man, I think I'm going to move to California and sell my house and move to California. And so we walked through all that diligently, and he moved out there. She's had an amazing storybook life. You need to have her come here, you know, and share her story, Ben. But she's an attorney, a partner in a law firm now, just an amazing life. But they're getting married in October, a few months after Georgia and that. So he moved out there. He goes, I don't know what I'm going to do for a living. I said, well, what do you want to do? He goes, I want to get a job where I just help people. That's all I want to do. I just want to help people. And I said, well, I got a friend, Billy, who works out there at the Midnight Mission. I said, why don't you give him a job? And he did, and long story short, that's where he went to work, and he works right next to Georgia every day of his life, and it's been that way for, I don't know how long now, quite a while. That's the impossible become impossible. How does that happen? But it's true, and I can sit here and tell you story after story that's like that. And as we wrap up here and get ready to go home, I mean, what are you doing? I mean, this is what our book asks us. I mean, and it's a very personal question all of us got to answer, but here's the question for all of us. You know, and the book's very humble about it. It says our book is meant to be suggestive only, and we realize we only know a little bit about this spiritual separation. But what we do know is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, one alcoholic talking to another. And Bill gives terminology for it on page 109 of the 12 and 12. He calls it the magnificent reality of Alcoholics Anonymous. That even the guy with brand new, as blind as he is, can help the person who's just brand new themselves. And that's what Gary did with me. My sponsor, Tom, used to say when he got a new guy, he gave him a mop before he gave him a book. The magic of service. And Joe spoke about this eloquently, about what I would call the gift of equality. The gift of just looking you in the eyes and you have value here. You have purpose here. You have status here. We're not hiring you. We're not lowering you. You are one among many. It's the most precious gift we can give anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is that very gift to look them in the eye and say, welcome home. We've heard it from every speaker this week. It's exactly the truth. You are here. And it's that when I'm in a treatment center, because I spend two days a week in a treatment center, I ask the group this question every single week. I got 50, 60, 70 new people every single week. Been doing this for years. And I ask them this question. What are your two biggest fears? Number one, relapse. Always number one. But number two is how do we continue this connection we got in here? These are my siblings. These are my sisters. These are my brothers. How do we keep this going? They'll never call it love. Never call it love. But they'll call it everything that's synonymous with it. Because that's just not even part of their love language. But why is that so powerful? Because love, it's the only thing your disease has no defense against. Yeah, your disease has absolutely no defense against it. And this unconditional, agape, unequivocal, pure generosity, genuine, equality, inclusive language, body language, demonstration, welcome home. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And that's what they're scared to death they're going to lose. They've only experienced. They're signing everybody's signing everybody's book. They're so excited. We're going to stay sisters and brothers forever. I still got my first big book. You would love it because it's got Gary, that guy who 12-stepped me, because all the pages are yellow, highlighted yellow. He told me, Harold, if they wanted the book to be yellow, they would have paid the visitors yellow. But I would repeat a lot of stuff. He gave me a fancy big book cover, and then he sent me a bumper sticker. I wish I had it with me, but it says, as Harold hears it. Yeah, and I still got it. I thought that was a compliment. It's not a compliment. But I go back and look at that sometimes, of all the people who signed that book in 1987. I don't know any of those people, where they're at. Most of them are probably gone or dead. You know, and... But it's that love. That's what we have. The language of the heart, whatever you want to call it. We have that gift. We have the gift to share that. I took a guy from prison. They just got out 90 days. You know, this is some time ago, and I sponsor a guy. He's a kidney doctor, and I a big long name. I'm not going to even begin to pronounce it. But he can't break his anonymity with his clients. But he'll call us when he needs to. And he called me and says, I got this guy, he's 30-something years old, liver's blown out, he's yellow, he's probably not going to make it, but he's willing to talk about this deal. Will you come up? And I took the guy 90 days with me. We go to see this guy. We go in and his dad's sitting there with his arms crossed. He's mad. He doesn't want to be there. His mom's hysterical because her son's about to die. He's only 30-something years old. And we just do what our book says. Hey, we need to meet our prospect alone. So we ask him to step out of the room. And they step out of the room, and we close the door, and we start having our conversation. Within minutes, we're laughing. We're cutting up. And within 30 minutes, we get ready to leave. And when we left, it was like all these ears were against the door. And everybody just fell in. And they followed us down the hall, this one particular clinician. And she asked the question, how did you do that? I said, how did we do what? How did you do what you did? He said, he's been here for 2 weeks, hasn't talked to anybody. You guys are strangers, show up within, you know, less than minutes. We could hear you in there laughing, cutting up. How do you do that? I said, it's the language of the heart. You're never going to get it in a book. It's the gift that keeps on giving. It's the gift you can only transmit what you got. And it tells us that here. It says, realize that we only know a little. God will constantly disclose to you and more to you and to us. And be honest with yourself. Do you do this? Ask God in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. Do you do that? Just be honest with you. I'm not asking for a show of hands, but that's our purpose. And as far as I'm concerned, not to do that is gross negligence. And my brother and sisters out there still lost, and I'm not going to any lengths to go grab them. It's gross negligence. And I'm missing the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm absolutely missing the magic of what this thing's all about. So we ask him, and what does it say? We ask for a morning meditation, what we can do each day for the man who's still sick, and the answers will come. What a promise. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you can't transmit something you haven't got. See to it your relationship with the Sibmarite is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him, right? Clear away the records of your past. Give freely what you got. Find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you tread the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. That's the calling order. That's what all this stuff, the spiritual separation, overcome that. You have to have that transformation. And I'll close with this. On page 152, the fellowship asked the member asked the fellowship a question. Here's the question. Do you have a sufficient substitute for King Alcohol? And it is a fair question, because nothing on this God's green earth, my mother's love, playing music, playing sports, nothing's ever duplicated. Do you got a sufficient substitute? And the book says yes. And it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the word fellowship, if you look at it, it's in the verb form, right? It's in the verb form. But if you embrace this way of life, your imagination will be fired. You're going to make lifelong friends, evidence right here, right now. The most satisfactory years of your existence, you've heard it all weekend. But here's the cream of the crop. You're going to have the privilege, and I'm paraphrasing, but you're going to have the privilege to walk shoulder to shoulder with other people and help them rediscover life. And if you do that long enough, you're going to finally know what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. That's the transformation from a taker to a giver. You gave me that principle life to talk about, practice these principles all year fair. If I had to sum them up in four, it would be these four. Number one, live a life of humility. It doesn't mean we don't have goals, ambitions, save money, and strive for this. It means that we put God's ambitions ahead of ours. That's all that means. I'm going to put God's ambitions ahead of mine. Two-word prayer, use me. But number two is that you live a life of self-sacrifice. Number three, that you live a life of other-centeredness. And number four, go out into the world and love everybody. Include the people you just don't care for. And if you do that, I can promise you, you will have a storybook life. It's happened in my life. So thank you for my life. Thank you for the opportunity, Ben. Have a safe trip home.